This is Theory of Change. I'm Matthew Sheffield. The internet and the explosion of free political content that it created has had a dramatic effect on the media industry, as previously profitable newspapers and magazines have slashed the budget in the hopes of surviving in the marketplace, while also being eaten alive by hedge funds that have become notorious for carving up publications and selling off the parts. One sector of journalism that's been particularly harmed in recent years is editorial cartooning. Not even 10 years ago, most major city daily newspapers employed artists to draw their takes on the news of the day. Now, however, the ranks of editorial cartoonists have shrunk drastically. That's more than a little bit ironic, however, because we live during a time when the visual image has never been more important in American culture, thanks to the popularity of memes, those images with funny and often political messages that even your grandparents know about. That's why several of America's top editorial cartoonists have joined together to form their own media outlet called Counterpoint.com. It's dedicated solely to gathering high-quality artists from both sides of the political spectrum and presenting their work to the public. In this episode, I'm joined by Nick Anderson, one of Counterpoint's co-founders who formerly worked at the Houston Chronicle. I'm also joined by Nate Beeler, a veteran cartoonist who draws at Counterpoint after previously working at the Columbus Dispatch. In our conversation, we talk about Counterpoint, the news industry, and cartooning during the age of the meme. We also discuss why artists expressing their opinions seem to face more anger from political opponents than people who write or speak their opinions. Nick, why don't we first start off with sort of the general trend. How many newspapers currently have editorial cartoonists on staff? And where was it formerly?
I'm guessing around 25, Nate. Do you have a more firm number?
That sounds about right.
Yeah, we're down from, like, when I started this in 1991, there were probably 180 editorial cartoonists on staff, so you can see what's happened.
Yeah. So, Nate, you were one of those rarer numbers as a staff cartoonist at the Columbus Dispatch for a while. What happened? Were you among many of the print casualties that happened over there? Or what was, tell us a little bit about how long you were at the Columbus Dispatch and then what you were doing before that and maybe what you see as the prospects of the industry.
Sure, yeah. I was laid off in May this year. A wave of layoffs across the Gatehouse company. There were other cartoonists who were swept up in this. Rick McKee was one. I believe Mark Streeter was another. I can't remember offhand if there were more than that. But there were other people whose jobs were eliminated at the Dispatch as well. So it wasn't they weren't just targeting editorial cartoonists, but at the same time, there are now no longer any editorial cartoonists working for Gatehouse newspapers. And
how many newspapers do they own?
Oh, gosh, I don't recall offhand, but, you know, hundreds. And now that their Gatehouse-Gannett merger has been approved, I don't know if there are any Gannett cartoonists out there except for maybe Mike Thompson, who's at USA Today now, even though he's in Detroit. And so I don't know what the future is in that respect now, but Gatehouse getting rid of all their editorial cartoonists was certainly troubling for the industry. And I had been there at the Columbus Dispatch for 7 years, having come back home to Columbus after spending about 7.5 years at the Washington Examiner in D.C. as their cartoonist.
Yeah. So, Nick, why have artists been included among these layoffs to such a degree? Or even more?
Well,
I think they're laid off even more so than reporters, it would seem.
Exactly. Even more so than reporters. And newspapers are left with, instead of having one cartoonist, zero, which tells you a lot about how their priorities have shifted. And I think part of it is their writers, a cartoonist I know calls it a newspaper's a writer's cult. So we've always been sort of add-ons, and it's not that we didn't feel valued, we did, but I think when they're under pressure and looking for things to cut, they start looking at the people who aren't writers. Sometimes it's photographers, and all too often it's editorial cartoonists, and they think they can take the easy way out and use syndicated material. In that case, it also saves trouble from readers, because if there's an editorial cartoon that is troublesome or too provocative, they just don't have to run it. Whereas if it's the staff cartoonist, you get into an argument about whether or not something should be run or not. So I think they're making a miscalculation.
Yeah, without a doubt.
But I don't think we can talk about this without really bringing up Counterpoint, which we touched on briefly. Counterpoint is basically before this came along, it was looking pretty grim for editorial cartoonists. When Rob Rod just got fired for drawing Trump cartoons at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. I wrote a column that landed in CNN.com and about the state of editorial cartooning and how bad it is, you know, things we've already covered. And a venture capitalist saw it, contacted me, and said, hey, why don't we do something about this? And that was a year and a half ago. But what we went through a few iterations of ideas, and what we ended up with was just kind of an experiment. We decided to start an email newsletter, and we wanted to have all perspectives represented, left and right, and, you know, in between. So that's how the name Counterpoint came up. And it was really, he didn't want to, the venture capitalist name is Vivek Garipalli, and he reads everything from left to right, and that's why he really wanted to have all sides represented. But he really wanted to kind of just test the market and see how much interest there is in this. And so this is an effort to decouple our faiths from newspapers and to not have editors breathing down our necks. So we can pretty much do whatever we want. There's no editors, except we kind of keep each other in check to make sure we don't do something stupid. And just it tells you how big a mistake that newspapers are making, how successful this newsletter is becoming. In June, we had 1,000 subscribers, and today we have 180,000 subscribers. It's growing 5,000 to 10,000 subscribers a week. It's growing like wildfire, and we expect to be over 200,000 by the end of the year. And that just shows you how much interest there is in what we do, and how, especially if we're pushing the envelopes with real commentary and not pulling our punches, people want to see that, and newspapers are making a mistake keeping it out of the newspaper.
Yeah, now, well, speaking to the idea of controversy, you still see some controversies periodic. The New York Times, as I recall, is probably the most recent one. Can you guys maybe talk a little bit about that episode if you remember it?
Yeah, that wasn't even somebody who worked for the New York Times. It was a syndicated piece that some editor ran. And what we're talking about is there was an uproar over a cartoon of Netanyahu as a dog, as a seeing eye dog for Trump. And people went crazy about it and said, this is anti-Semitic, drawing Jewish person as a dog. And there was so much controversy and blowback that in the end, they said they would stop using cartoons altogether, stop using any from this syndicate. And then soon after, they fired Patrick Chabot, who had nothing to do with this, but they got rid of him as well. So it seemed like an incredible overreaction.
And what about you, Nate? What's your take?
As a political cartoonist, I think you have to have a pretty thick skin. And also, you think in extremes. And so sometimes you can be blind to the things that would make other people uncomfortable. And using anti-Semitic tropes right now, in light of stuff that's gone on with Representative Omar and so forth, sensitivity was heightened. And I think that it's always dangerous when you start using tropes, especially ones that have a long history of being really disgusting. In this case, it was, I think, an unfortunate use of that trope. I don't think that the person is necessarily anti-Semitic, but given the context of the politics, it was probably the wrong time to use that image. However, that's an image that the editor could have rejected before publication, and they had every right to reject it because they were paying for it. And the cartoonist was the one, two cartoonists, that cartoonist who done the cartoon, and then Patrick Chabot afterwards, paid the price for the editor's own mistake. And the editor is probably still working there. So, I mean, I didn't see the cartoon when it was first printed. I understand why people were upset over it. And as a cartoonist, I wouldn't have drawn that image myself because I don't like to get into those waters to begin with. It's better to use imagery that is a little more closer to the situation, first of all. And it also helps you avoid stereotypes that have ugly histories.
Uh-huh. The cartoonist in question is actually Norwegian. Have you guys followed where he is at or if he had any issues in Norway?
I have not heard anything since. And the one thing that I was curious about was whether or not he had a history of anti-Semitic images, and he really didn't. I don't think that the intention was anti-Semitic. Like Nate said, it's kind of an old trope. I've drawn Trump as a seeing eye dog for Putin. We use these images pretty regularly, but you do have to be conscious of the history of images and how they've been used against some groups more than others. And I think the cartoonist just did this because it fit, not because he was trying to be anti-Semitic. But that's where an editor or other eyes on it can help you avoid a train wreck like that. But I don't think it was intentional.
Uh-huh. Right. And as an editorial cartoonist, you know, you always have to take context into account. You can't necessarily throw every single stereotypical image out the door, though. And there are times when you can use it. But I always go back to when I was in college and drawing cartoons for my college newspaper. I was told right off the bat that I couldn't draw any cartoons with monkeys or gorillas in them because all of that imagery was just taken away from me. And it was because there was a cartoon in the student newspaper a few years before I came to it that involved a monkey, and it was taken the wrong way, and they accused the newspaper of being racist. So, you know, there are plenty of times where I could draw a monkey and have it not be racist, yeah, and I've done so professionally. For the examiner, I can recall a specific cartoon where I drew the national debt as a big gorilla, you know, 800-pound gorilla. But I couldn't have drawn that cartoon for my student newspaper in college because of the context. So you always have to weigh the context and whether to go with an image that is potentially a landmark.
Is there a pressure on cartoonists to be as inoffensive as possible?
There's certain artists who I won't necessarily name, but it seems to me that they're trying to be almost generic.
People of any political persuasion would say, oh yeah, haha, that's slightly amusing. But otherwise, they don't really do a lot. And I think it seems like that's a pressure that is within the industry, but you guys are in it, so you tell me.
The answer is yes. In newspapers, they definitely want cartoons that are as inoffensive as possible. And at my old newspaper, The Dispatch, you know, they would go out of their way to put cartoons in that were more jokes than editorial statements. They would shy away from editorial statements at times. And it was difficult to watch as a cartoonist because your job is to make an editorial statement. You are an editorial cartoonist. So that opinion is at the core of your title. And it's the first word in the title. And newspapers are just under a lot of pressure to not piss off readers. And it's not necessarily pressure from the readers, I think. I think it's internal pressure and pressure from the bean counters, if you will.
Uh-huh. Well, and have you guys had responses from readers? I imagine you've had some responses from them as in terms of what they think and their appreciation.
Yes, positive and negative. In fact, recently one of our cartoonists used the basket of deplorables reference from Hillary and drew the Trump's basket of deplorables, and there was a Nazi symbol in there. And one of our cartoonists had several comments on Facebook complaining about Counterpoint, how this really should be out of bounds and we shouldn't be letting these kind of cartoons into Counterpoint. And Nate, who's one of our cartoonists, we're lucky to have him, they brought up his name and because he had used the jackboot as a metaphor for Trumpism, and they were just mortified by this imagery. And you know, I chimed in. Rick, who's a conservative, said, look, we can draw whatever we want, and that's the way we like it. This is the way it should work. We shouldn't have an editor saying, no, you can't do that, because that's going to end up working both ways. And that really is what I think is, it's going to make people uncomfortable, but that's a good thing, as long as it's not something that traffics in just blatantly racist stereotype. But I think using Nazi imagery is fair play, and I think conservatives call liberals communists. I also think that's fair play, and I think it's pretty equivalent.
Mm-hmm. So, Nate, yeah, I think in addition to the general industry trends, you came out of a conservative background and have been continued to be a Donald Trump critic long after most people who claimed they were never Trump, well, they actually decided they were in favor of Trump. So how has that experience been like for you as a cartoonist? And I mean, have any other people, let's say writers or cartoonists had some similar experiences to you? But first talk about yourself.
Well, it's been weird since 2015. I remember way back when I was in the Examiner, this was maybe around 2000, 2010 or 2011, Donald Trump had a little trial balloon that he would possibly throw his name in the running for a run against Obama. And that was when I drew my first Trump cartoon. I mean, it just seemed ridiculous on its face to, for him to be a candidate. And so I came into his candidacy in 2016 with a whole bunch of skepticism. And the way that he comported himself on the campaign trail just did everything to cement that opinion that he's dangerous and he's not conservative, first of all. And I've always been one to, I've always been attracted to people who are, this will trigger some people, who are uniters and not dividers. So I like a president to be presidential and to have a sense of fairness to him and compassion. And so I just didn't like him from the beginning. And it went along. It just got worse and worse. And I remember I was drawing these cartoons during the primaries about Trump, and another cartoonist, Steve Stack, sent me a email about one of my cartoons saying that he liked it. And he said, so how long before you're going to pivot me to supporting him when, if he wins the nomination? And he was saying it, you know, wryly, you know, as Steve does. But I responded to him and I said, listen, you know, if he wins the nomination, it's not going to change my view of him. You know, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm an editorial cartoonist. And, you know, I have, you know, core values that are conservative in some ways, liberal in others. But I'm not going to change who I am just because he gets the Republican nomination. And so when he got it and I was still drawing cartoons critical of Trump, there were a whole bunch of people that jumped on me, readers who jumped on me and accusing me of being a liberal and, you know, Obama lover and all that.
And this is when you were at the Dispatch, right?
Exactly, yes. And this is 2016 and beyond. They would say, oh, you probably loved Obama and all that. I would always say, hey, go look at my Obama cartoons and send them links to those, because it's our job as editorial cartoonists to see a check on power. And guess what? The most powerful person in the world is the commander in chief of the United States.
Yeah. Well, and I think, and this is something that I have heard from some other people who had worked in conservative oriented media, that it's their opinion that there is a lot more pressure to have conformity among conservative outlets. And as a result, a lot of these people had decided they couldn't take it anymore and they went mainstream. What do you think of that assessment?
I think that there probably is a whole lot of pressure to conform in Washington, D.C. itself, because Washington is very tribal. And I think if you get into the Midwest, it's a lot less tribal. You have a lot of the gray in the middle. And if you're in Washington, you have to go to the extreme to be able to be heard. And that just, I don't think it plays well for the majority of the people in the United States. It just shows that our politics are being run by and supported by, I think, fewer and fewer people going forward. Maybe the numbers don't back me up on that, but it just seems like the extremes having the power points to a more troubling trend, because I don't think that the majority of people in the United States are on these extremes. And in terms of people having to conform and then leaving and joining mainstream, you know what? Who cares where you go? If you believe one thing, let's say you are for path to legalization or whatever for immigrants or something like that. If you're for that fundamentally, you shouldn't change your view just because somebody gets to be president who doesn't share your view. So I don't like hypocrisy. That's one of the things that people like Nick and I are supposed to call out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Nick, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think maybe one of the things you're trying to do is to try to end some of that siloing with your project. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's one of the internal debates that we had with the co-founders was we were getting a little bit of blowback from readers because conservatives like Nate and Scott Stannis were a little bit more independent-minded about Trump and were critical of him. And then, like, Mike Lester is far more in the Trump camp and is a big supporter, which is fine. But we were not having perfect balance in every issue. And so the co-founders were like, well, what are we going to do? And I said, we're going to do nothing. I don't want this to turn into the CNN's Crossfire, which was a dreadful show where you knew what everyone was going to say ahead of time because everyone was taking their prescribed positions. I want Counterpoint to be a place where people can think freely and express freely. And like Nate said, Trumpism is not conservatism. And criticizing Trump from a conservative point of view is very valid and should be represented. And we're never going to move as a country if everyone just stays in their lane and isn't free to think freely. So I was adamant that we just not fall into that same, I think, siloing and that is very, very much contaminating our body politics. And I just want us to be something different, dynamic, where you're not going to see three cartoons from the left and three from the right. You'll see three from liberals and three from conservatives, but you're not going to know what they have to say. They may have something, they may surprise you, and I think that's a good thing.
Uh-huh. Well, and it's such a fascinating idea, this pressure on cartoonists, because I do think it's unique compared to pressure on columnists. Like, I mean, there might be some instances here and there where people might not like a particular column or whatnot, but in general, you don't see people who are writing political columns trying to make them as anodyne as possible. I just don't see that. And I mean, tell me if I'm wrong.
I think you're absolutely right. And I don't know why there's extra pressure on cartoonists, but we do make people mad. Go ahead, Nate.
Yeah, the reason why is because there's so much power in an image that is imparted so quickly. You can have a fiery column, something that is really controversial and pointed, but you have to make your way through the column. And so the emotion of that builds up for the most part, in most cases. And for an editorial cartoon, it is in your face. And this hard opinion or uncomfortable truth that this cartoonist might get to is right there and is absorbed within 5 seconds, just looking at the pictures.
Yeah. And so-and-so is an arrogant asshole. You can get that message immediately.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
Just from the way that they're drawn. Yep. And it's the power of images. And this is what's so amazing to me about newspapers and the layoffs and so forth. You know, Nick mentioned photographers getting laid off. Yeah. Are the illustration staffs at newspapers, photographers, editorial cartoonists, all these people, you know, designers and so forth, all these people are image-based people. And newspapers are doing away with them. Well, look at what the technology is bringing to us nowadays with the web and social media. It's all tailored to images. It's images exploit images the best.
Mm-hmm. The other co-founders of Counterpoint are Silicon Valley mindset, and they've asked me, why are newspapers getting rid of something that caters to the visual and the short attention span of modern America? Why? And I can't answer that, but it makes no sense, but it's giving us a huge opportunity.
Yeah, well, if I had to theorize on why they're doing it, it's that the people who are ascending to the executive level, the C-suite in the newspaper industry, they are individuals who are not good at building things. All they are good at is cutting costs and destroying things. So in the case of, so I actually used to work at the Examiner as well. And in my experience, the guy who was the head of the company, he literally had that job because he had destroyed the Rocky Mountain News and had done it by cutting the Denver Post to the bone. And then as a result, drove them out of business. And he just didn't have a lot of integrity or interest in journalism from what I saw. But I don't want to open a can of worms for you there, Nate. But yeah, so now in terms of Counterpoint, Nick, tell the listeners here, do you guys have any, what are your other plans, or have you finalized any yet?
We are constantly reevaluating. We are published twice a week right now, Tuesdays and Thursdays. It's free. We intend to keep it free. We are currently looking for sponsorship. At the rate we're growing, we no longer talk about whether or not Counterpoint is going to succeed. We talk about it just succeeding. We hope to be published daily in 2020. That's looking pretty realistic right now, especially it's great timing with the 2020 election coming up. So we are bringing in some staffers to handle some writing and to handle management and in advertising. And we've got some advertisers right now interested. They're mostly recent startups, Silicon Valley startup types. So things are looking very, very good. And what also makes us different is that we pay for original work. We are not a syndicate. We pay cartoonists to do cartoons for Counterpoint, 12 a week. Well, each cartoonist does one for a Tuesday or Thursday. And so they meet a deadline, they get their work in, we pay them pretty well given the current market, and we'd like to even increase that. Whereas syndication rates are terrible, but we didn't want to just use syndicated material because it's recycled. You can find it everywhere else, but this is different in that you can only see these cartoons in Counterpoint, at least for the first 24 hours, and it gives cartoonists a possible new business model to survive professionally, especially as we move into publishing daily.
Uh-huh. Have you guys thought about doing things like web widgets or something so that people could put the cartoons on their websites?
That's pretty far down the line. We want to grow. Right now, the newsletter business model is looking really good. We kind of stumbled into this, but we've discovered that the newsletter business model is actually a really hot right now. So we are focusing on that for the moment. As we mature, I think we'll start looking for other ways we can leverage the asset further down the line.
Okay. And so, Nate, you are affiliated with Counterpoint, but also you are working with Kegel Cartoons. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've been syndicated with Kegel Cartoons since, I think, 2006 or 2007, back when I was at the Examiner. And it's just a longstanding relationship. I do cartoons for my home newspaper, the Examiner, and then for the Dispatch. And I would then give those cartoons to my syndicate to send out or to make available to other newspapers and who are subscribers. And that works the same now with Counterpoint. And I'm sure the Nick set up with Washington Post Writers Group is not the same. You know, his home newspaper is probably Counterpoint now. Is that right, Nick?
Yeah, I would say.
And yeah, so that's the way that I look at it. Home, Counterpoint's the new home. And then it just the cartoons go to the syndicate for wider distribution after the 24 hours availability to Counterpoint. And that's sort of it's a standard sort of business model for a relationship for editorial cartoonists. And, you know, other cartoonists can have, you know, different wrinkles to their syndicate deals, but that's generally the way it works. And Kegel is been really good to me over the years, and it's, you know, it's got a whole lot of subscribers to it, so it's always fun being able to see my cartoons in other publications and, you know, have friends or family members come back from vacation someplace and say, oh, we saw your cartoon in this paper, saw it in this magazine.
Uh-huh.
You know, the whole point of getting into journalism, yeah, is because you want to communicate with people, right? And as an editorial cartoonist, you want your cartoons to be seen by as many people as possible. So syndications really goes to that, getting your message out to as many people as possible.
Yeah. Well, and actually maybe that's another question for both of you is, how did you guys get into cartooning?
Nate, you want to go first? You want me to? I'll go ahead.
You go ahead.
So I've been drawing all my life. I was the youngest of 11 kids, six blood siblings and then four step siblings. But the step siblings joined the family when I was about five, so they're like brothers and sisters. But I think being the youngest of 11, I just felt like I had to do something different. And my mother was an artist, and I think I was inspired by that. My father was a scientist, biochemist. And somehow there has always been this kind of even balance between left and right brain with me. I'm analytical, but also creative. And I've been drawing all my life, but then, you know, I was interested in doing comics, and then looking through the paper to get to the comics, I stumbled across the editorial cartoons in the paper one day. And I'm like, this is amazing. Beautifully drawn cartoons that get across an opinion and ridicule our politicians. This is pretty cool. And I started doing it my freshman year in high school and never stopped. Did it for my college paper and landed a job out of college. And I've been lucky enough to do it professionally my whole career until 2 years ago. So I've done nothing else pretty much my whole life.
Okay. And Nate?
Yeah, I have a similar sort of backstory as well. So I was really into comic strips and comic books when I was in elementary school and middle school. So I wanted to be a comic book artist, like comic book penciler. That's what I thought I wanted to be in seventh grade. And I think I drew my first editorial cartoon in fifth grade for a school project. And it was Saddam Hussein cartoon during the Persian Gulf War. And I came back to that, I guess, in high school, when I was in detention for drawing on desks in school. And the high school newspaper advisor saw me in there, and I was doodling in a notebook, and she came up to me and said, maybe you could draw some cartoons for us next year. And so I started drawing editorial cartoons for my school newspaper. And I was attracted to them because it was like, oh, you can do cartoony stuff, but it's serious too. So people will take you seriously, right? And so it's elevating this low art form. You know, comics are considered low art, right? It takes, you know, especially in comic books, it takes an incredible amount of skill and talent to be able to do it, but it's still this low art. I never understood that. But yeah, you're doing this fun drawing style and talking about big issues. It seemed like this is a really cool thing. And then it had this great history, you know, Benjamin Franklin being the first American editorial cartoonist, and editorial cartoons created the modern image of Santa Claus and the donkey and the elephant and the political parties. You know, it's ingrained in the fabric of America. And so I was drawn to it because I could do something silly and serious at the same time. And so I continued that through high school and college, and I was able to make a career of it.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, going back to the idea of having cartoons be as inoffensive as possible, is that, like, I'm just thinking, seems like every year or so, there's always one cartoon that people are just, you know, oh, this is outrageous. This person needs to be fired. Going back to what you said, Nate, about the power of the image, that you don't see that about columns. Somebody saying this columnist needs to be fired. That simply just doesn't happen.
Well, one of the reasons why I think that happens is because with a column, you can couch everything. You can give context to everything. You have all these words to work with to be able to make something nuanced. And you can have nuances in editorial cartoons, but when it gets down to it, it's a distillation of a column. If it's in your own head, obviously, but it's distilling all these thoughts and bypassing all of the nuance to get to the final distilled opinion.
I also think that because editorial cartoons have to be interpreted, that there is sometimes agendas projected onto a cartoon, pre-existing agendas. So, for instance, the New York Times controversy, people that are already inclined to be angry at the New York Times and want to discredit them will seize on something like a cartoon to push their agenda and say, this is clearly intended to be anti-Semitic or whatever, or just poor journalism. And I think you find that with a lot of these cartoons. They may be poorly executed, but oftentimes there's also some projection going on or some willful misinterpretation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think so. Now, I guess one of the other things, and you guys have talked about it a little bit, the idea of the popularity of the image in the modern web. In a sense, though, is it possible that editorial cartooning has felt pressure not just from above with the people writing the checks, but also from below, in that anybody can make a meme now? Is that you guys think that's played a role or not really?
I think it has. Memes are pretty immediate. They are visual. They work on social media. I mean, they're different in many important respects, but they kind of hit the same buttons at times, and they can be out faster than a cartoon because they can be thrown together. And what also, one of the things with memes is people think of them as free and not copyrighted and to be used however somebody wants. And cartoonists, social media is a double-edged sword for us. It is a great way to get your message out. Cartoons can go viral. They're copied and pasted all over. And that's also what makes it very difficult to monetize them today, because seeing one of my cartoons go viral is always a little bittersweet, because it's like, oh God, I'm not getting a dime from this, or even a penny, but Facebook is, or Twitter or whatever. And I used to try to, because I was trying to drive traffic to my newspaper's website, I would reach out to people who were doing it habitually, and I would ask them to stop, and they'd say, oh, I'm free to use memes. I'm giving your meme some exposure. It was like a double insult. They're calling my cartoon a meme, and they're using it, and they're violating the copyright, and they don't care. So anyway, Nate, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement in that we get nothing from going viral, and it's because of that history now with memes. Everything is free. And
yeah.
You know, it's the same thing with writers, though, I would say, you know, because, you know, people are sharing news stories. Yes, now newspapers are putting up paywalls, but you can do clippings from the story, you know, take screen captures and so forth and put those in a tweet. But the difference between editorial cartoons and memes is huge, mm-hmm. because like Nick said, a meme is something that could be done just really quickly. You know, it's like you take an existing picture, something that's cultural touchstone. Paul Rudd, like, look at us, right? From the Hot Wings Challenge thing or whatever. You can take something like that that everybody knows and slap some big white font on it and say something clever, you know, your own hot take. Well, that's all good. It's quick and it's clever, whatever. But there's something about a drawn image, a hand-drawn cartoon, that I think taps into something incredibly primal to us as a species. We've been drawing on things since we were drawn on cave walls. So you look at words, those letters are actually drawings. They come from drawings. And there's just something that taps into a very caveman part of us that makes cartoons even more effective, I think, than memes. More interesting to look at. You can linger on them. You can appreciate the artistry of them as well as the wit of the message and the issues that they're talking about. So it's got a lot going on in it that you can appreciate beyond, you know, 10 seconds of recognition of what it's saying.
There's also another important distinction. And I'll just say that some of my readers have accused me of being a caveman as well. But the memes are not signed. You don't know where they came from. There's no transparency. In a way, that can be a little insidious. They could be created in a Russian troll farm. You don't know where they came from. And cartoons are signed. You have accountability. And whoever created that meme could have motives other than what they're displaying in the meme. There could be underhanded motives. There could be hidden agendas. And there's no voice. And the one thing I like about following cartoonists is, you know, you get to know their voice after a while and become familiar with it and either like it or hate it. But I do like that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, it does seem like the meme as an art form is becoming more elaborate, especially with the advent of deep fakes and you know, the video meme. So I mean, is that do you think that cartooning itself might transition in that direction, or is that already doing that in some people's work?
I think it's already doing it in some people's work. I mean, what's it's incredibly meta now, because, you know, you have the image of Pepe the Frog by the alt-right, and that's from a cartoon. And then that has been used. Also, the alt-right version of Pepe the Frog has been lampooned in editorial cartoons after the fact. And it's incredibly meta how that went about. But, there's stuff that means there's memes out there that are being incorporated into cartoons and referenced all the time. You know, another example is, I forget the cartoonist's name who did the image, but the dog in the burning room, this is fine.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's a trope that's used in cartoons a lot nowadays.
Mm-hmm. I guess one other sort of internet-related controversy. Did you guys, have you ever paid any attention to the saga of Ben Garrison? Have you guys followed him at all?
Yeah.
you want to talk about that at all? Because I don't know if you know the background of the neo-Nazis editing his cartoons. Have you heard about that?
I don't think I've heard that.
Oh, okay. Well, basically, so Ben Garrison, kind of this kooky Ron Paul type cartoonist, mm-hmm. and of course, you know, is loves Trump now. But earlier in his career, before Trump came along, he used to do a lot of cartoons critical of the Federal Reserve and some of these other organizations that are subject of conspiracy theories. And what happened is that his work was discovered by people on the website, which doesn't exist anymore, 8chan, the politically incorrect board. And what they did was that they began altering his cartoons to have anti-Semitic imagery in his cartoons. And then, but they kept them signed under his name. And he threatened to sue them numerous times for doing that, but they just kept laughing him off, and he never sued them. And then eventually he actually started to just accept that they were doing it and ended up advertising on 8chan to his own personal website. It's a very strange story.
Yes.
I didn't know the backstory on that. I knew that I've seen his anti-Semitic stuff. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting backstory.
Yeah.
it shows the opportunism of Trumpism is really what it's all about. There are all these people out there who are just taking the opportunity to, no matter what it is and what comes along with it, if it just means more eyeballs and more support.
Yeah, well, and I think maybe one example of that would be that, you know, in the impeachment hearings that are going on, there's all this constant talk from Trump-supporting Republicans on the Intelligence Committee that, oh, well, all this information is secondhand. No, you don't have direct knowledge of what you're talking about. But then at the same time, they also block all people who have direct knowledge from testifying.
Right. Yes. Yes. And everybody has direct knowledge now because the transcript's been released.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, that will do it for this episode. I appreciate my two guests today. Nick Anderson, the co-founder of Counterpoint.com, a editorial cartoon website and email newsletter, and Nate Beeler, one of the people who is an artist for Counterpoint. Thanks for being with me today, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Theory of Change. I'm Matthew Sheffield. Be sure to subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platforms. We're on Apple, Google, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and all the rest.